Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The intersection of art and activism. When does the potter make the leap from simple vessel to a statement on the affairs of the world? And how does theater continue to adapt to changing issues of the day? And do the best examples remain relevant? Coming up later, we'll hear from a nationally ranked college wrestler and now coach at Columbia University. He used his athletic platform to raise awareness about homophobia in sports and now is using his training as a performance artist to do the same. We'll also hear from the folks at Available Light Theater about their latest production, this one addressing food issues. Right now, we welcome Christopher Bedford. He's the chief curator of exhibitions at the Wexner Center for the Arts, the multidisciplinary contemporary art center at Ohio State University. Christopher was formerly assistant curator in contemporary art at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. He serves on the Arts and Memorials Public Art Committee at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Pleasure to be here.
You've worked with many established and emerging artists in your role as curator at the Wexner. Yeah. How common is it nowadays to find artists who are engaged in social activism through their work?
I wouldn't go as far as to say it's the norm, but I would say within the field I work in, and I think it has a relationship to my own predilections as curator, I'm looking for some degree of formal invention in the art that I'm looking at, and also some degree of social embeddedness. So it's almost a precondition for me of the most successful and relevant art being produced today. And I think that the Wexner Center's agenda, as sort of shepherded by me and by Sherry Geldon, the director, since I arrived, has spoken to those dual interests, whether it be, say, a Mark Bradford exhibition that we did in 2009 that's currently touring the United States. He was fundamentally an abstract painter, but the materials he uses are all gathered from a South Central neighborhood in Los Angeles where he lives and works. And so his painting has a natural relationship to a social environment while also advancing a formal discourse that goes all the way back to the middle of the 20th century. So even when the social relevance isn't perhaps as glaring as it was in, say, the Hard Targets exhibition that we did that looked at the intersection of sport, masculinity, sexuality, economics, race, it's always there.
When you talk about, you said the formal invention, I think, yeah, is the way you put it.
Yeah.
That's the materials that they actually use.
Yeah, exactly. So I think what I'm always looking for is a certain energy in an artist's work with materials and a desire to look at the past and try and advance a whole different set of ideas based on a new use of materials. So that's one precondition. Then I'm looking for them to use those materials in such a way that they have a broader resonance to, you know, a bigger public, so that there are numerous points of intersection for me as an art historian and then for, you know, the person who lives next door to me who may not have any training in art history but is conversant in some of the social questions that the artist might be addressing.
You said it's not necessarily the norm, the arts and the activism, mm-hmm, intersection, but does it tend to be more interesting?
I think so, absolutely. You know, I would say that the term activism probably raises the bar a little bit.
Right.
There are some artists who inhabit that terrain, but others are just socially engaged and artistic producers. I would say that's the norm in my segment of the art world.
There is a, I think they still teach the class, the environmental class for high school students,
sure,
at the Wexner.
Yeah.
And there was an artist who was visiting and spoke to them at a class 3 or 4 years ago, mm-hmm, when I visited.
Mm-hmm.
And she was drawing a line,
mm-hmm,
around New York City or around the coast up there, showing where the water levels would be,
mm-hmm,
as the glaciers melt. Mm-hmm. And I thought that – and that was art.
Yes, absolutely.
She was actually drawing the line on the city streets and the sidewalks of New York City.
Yeah, I think some of those really apparently simple ideas that give form to an idea in such a way that becomes intelligible to people are really important. And even if the artistic gesture is perhaps more rudimentary or simple, it isn't as visually gripping, it might be really topical, and I think that's a really good example. And in fact, we have a suite of exhibitions coming up at the Wexner Center in fall of this year that has a relationship to exactly that subject. So we're forming a suite of exhibitions, beginning with a video installation in the lobby by Diana Thayer, who's one of the most eminent video artists in the world. And then there'll be a monographic presentation of Paula Hayes' work in the first gallery, an enormous presentation of Alexis Rockman's work. He's a painter. The retrospective exhibition was organized by the Smithsonian. That will occupy two galleries. And the last will be a group of new work by Elliot Hunley, who's an LA-based artist. And the binding conceit for the whole suite of exhibitions is a kind of environmental consciousness, a kind of an investment in eco-questions, and perhaps artists more engaged than others in questions of how to be most and most effectively green in the world. So Paul is somebody, for example, who works with actual living plant life in her sculptures. She creates terrariums that are themselves living environments for small ecosystems she creates. So it's a way of sponsoring the idea of life and creating life and then creating a sculpture from those things. So it's and quite aside from everything else, they're beautiful. This mm-hmm. is completely stunning. So we're really hoping that this is a point of entry for people to think about different ways that art is able to engage with environmental consciousness, environmental sustainability, et cetera.
Harold, you're from the university area, and we welcome you to the show.
Thank you, and I'm loving this topic. I'm wondering, as a child, I was in the Cincinnati train station and still remember the paintings, the powerful paintings that they had in that train station. And when we moved to Columbus, I went to Bellows School, and that left an impression on me. And I'm wondering, in today's world, in the society that we have, in the concentration of wealth, who's speaking for the common people from the arts in today's society? Because it seems to me that with the kind of outcomes that we're having, the arts voice could be a very powerful mechanism for some sort of balance that is sorely needed in today's society.
When you're talking about those paintings, are you talking about like the Depression era paintings?
Well, I'm speaking more about the working class kind of theme that went with many of those paintings, both with Bellows and with those in the train station in Cincinnati. They were roundly criticized, as I recall, as being communist or socialist, the ones in Cincinnati at least. And Bellows, I think, took some heat for painting common people. But I'm wondering if the arts in general feels the need to speak out about the concentrations of wealth and the things that are going on in today's economic and political environment.
Christopher Bedford?
It's interesting. I was recently in Chicago for the opening of Mark Bradford's exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art there, and we gave a series of gallery lectures which were open to the general public. And the closing question from the last gallery talk I remember very clearly and resonates exactly with what you're saying. The woman in question said, "How do you as an artist relate to these times, specifically to the kind of economic trouble that common people are experiencing given your relative affluence?" And Mark, coming from a working class background himself, self-identified as a merchant, a person who began life as a hairdresser who lived in downtown Los Angeles, had a really interesting answer to that question. And I think you can see it in his work, but you can also see it in the ethics, the way he works with students, the way he works with people interested in his work. And he said his emphasis was not on what you don't have, but what you can do with what you do have. And he'd been working with a group of fairly disenfranchised students in downtown Chicago who themselves were aspiring artists. And it was clear to him that they came from a background not conducive to a life of exploration and leisure. And so he was finding creative ways to work with them with the materials available to them in their specific social environment. So it was interesting to me that he was able to stitch together limited means with a way to be creative. And I think that as a metaphor was to him extraordinarily important and a way for working class people like himself, in fact, to become involved in a higher level of discourse about contemporary culture and economics.
Just to piggyback on what Harold's, the point Harold's making is, how important is it to the art world that it does relate to more people than just the people who can afford to purchase it.
I think I can only speak for myself, but I think that's of absolutely vital importance. The collecting class, whether that the wealthy who collect privately or institutional collections who look for the most important art of any era and draw that into their collections, that's just one part of the art world. The people I think that institutions like the Wexner Center are trying to reach are way beyond that self-selecting demographic of experts or buyers. We want to fundamentally speak to a group of people who have an investment in the subjects that the artists are talking about. And artists, generally speaking, aren't talking about affluence and wealth. They're talking about social discontent, social disenfranchisement, racism, sexism, etc. So the points of intersection are always there in the work. It's just a question of finding a way to foreground that for the public and to draw them in. So that, I would say, is my central goal.
And likewise, the arts are always one of the first hit. Maybe not music per se, but certainly the fine arts of that you see, they're always first hit in the schools. They're going through a huge economic downturn right now. Yeah. Schools haven't even started. Yeah. The tsunami has not hit the schools yet this year. It will next year and the year after. Concerns about that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it forces you to think about what is the utility of art and culture. That's a really fundamental question. What does it actually do? And I think if you're outside the field, it's very easy to dismiss it as frivolous and socially not irrelevant, but perhaps not affecting a culture in the most direct way. So then you have to ask yourself, what is the effect? What happens when a person views a work of art? What happens in the space between that person and the object? And it's nothing tangible, necessarily. It has to do with a psychic or emotional effect that that object might have on a person. And to me, that is incredibly useful. That can shift a person's understanding of the world, which then causes them to behave differently in the world in a tangible way. I think the problem is making that case and making the case that that moment is important and needs to be part of a student's development when in middle school, high school, college, etc., to try and foreground that dimension of utility.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're going to continue our conversation about where art intersects with activism, social responsibility, social issues. If you have a question or comment, Christopher Bedford is going to stay with us. He's the chief curator of exhibitions at the Wexner Center for the Arts. Call 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
The Newark Catholic High School baseball team. With just over 200 students in the school, the baseball team has captured 4 state titles in the last decade. They play in the Division IV tournament with small public schools that lack the resources of a school that charges $4,000 a year in tuition.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and there are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or like WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Just visit WOSU.org/email to sign up. 73 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a nice day with a high of 79. Partly cloudy tonight and a low of 55. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the intersection of art and activism. My guest, Christopher Bedford, chief curator of exhibitions at the Wexner Center for the Arts. And joining us now, Hudson Taylor. I first learned about Hudson when I saw that he was booked to speak this weekend at the Human Rights Conference Columbus, Human Rights Campaign Columbus, I should say, a dinner at the Ohio Union at OSU on Saturday. Hudson may seem like an unlikely artist and activist. He is a wrestling coach at Columbia University. He was a three-time All-American wrestler in 2010 and currently ranks among the top five pinners in NCAA history. He grew up in an evangelical Christian family with missionary roots, and he is an outspoken advocate for gay rights, who founded a website, Athlete Allies, to encourage respect for athletes regardless of sexual orientation. And he's a performance artist who views his work as a creative encounter for the artist and the audience. And Hudson, you kind of inspired the show in the first place for me. Welcome.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's first start with the athletics part. It's not exactly art. However, you have likened your wrestling and that form of athletics to a form of art. And, of course, athletics is depicted in art all the time.
Sure. I mean, for me, it was, you know, I was a theater major when I first started at Maryland. And for me, both wrestling and theater are a performance in a way. You have an audience, you have a stage, so to speak. So I very much approach the two in a similar way as I could. Certainly, there's a little different preparation that goes into each, but you know, I think wrestling is a performance. So,
at what age did you become aware of what is a pretty well accepted, not accepted in terms of people accept it, but we acknowledge it as a pretty well acknowledged issue of gay intolerance in sports, particularly male sports?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been wrestling for the past 19 years, and I'd say, I mean, homophobic language, I think, evolves right around the same time when individuals are really becoming conscious of their own sexuality. So for me, you know, as a young wrestler, it was very apparent that my teammates and friends would use homophobic language in order to assert their own masculinity, in order to assert their own heterosexualness. from my experience, it's been used as a tool to define what one isn't. And I think that that's something that I'm constantly trying to change, trying to redefine what it means to be masculine, what it means to be feminine, really challenge some of those gender scripts, and I hope to make athletes just a little bit more conscious of how their words and actions affect others.
Let's listen to one of Hudson Taylor's performance videos titled Time to Evolve.
The world was no longer a place of the possible, but a box for the placeable. She is a girl. Girls like flowers and pink and jewelry. I am a boy. Boys like sports and camouflage and sharks.
What inspired that? During that video, you're being made up.
Yes, my fiance was putting makeup on me throughout that. So I started with this nice full beard, and she shaved my beard and even tried to wax a little bit, which was an epic failure.
Yes.
But really, you know, the more I've studied and learned, the more conscious I've been of, I think, the boundaries that have been placed upon me as a straight man, as an athlete. You know, I think that whether it's society, whether it's your peers, people are always trying to shape you into what they expect of you. And that's something that I've actively tried to fight against, because I think it's hurtful and it causes a lot of sadness in a lot of people's lives. I mean, I get emails from a lot of closeted young athletes who don't feel comfortable coming out because, you know, they have parents who don't understand that, and who think that, you know, in order to be masculine, you have to be straight, and there is no other alternative. So it's something that I think really needs to change, and it's going to make the world a lot better when it does.
When Christopher Bedford, when Hudson made these points as an athlete, that was an activist talking. All things being equal, now as an artist, as a performance artist, it's something a little bit different. How important, and I know that the Wexner has dealt with these issues as well pretty recently.
Yeah, we did an exhibition called Hard Targets in 2009, and it was actually an outgrowth of an exhibition I did by the same name at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and it looked at precisely some of the issues that Hudson's discussing, which is a sort of messy intersection of sexuality, sporting images, the male body, economic questions, racial questions too, and how artists find different ways to negotiate that field. And I think every one of them involved in the show, from the most notable Matthew Barney, Douglas Gordon, some of the most revered living American and European artists, to some of the lesser known in the exhibition, like Sean Leonardo, who actually shares an interesting background with Hudson.
He
does the wrestling performances. He was a football player, I think, at Bowdoin or Bates, and then became an artist and has really made a name for himself. I think they would all understand themselves as performing or producing in such a way that they want to initiate a different understanding of gender and sexuality in sport through their work. And it appealed to me as an idea because, as I went to Oberlin College in Ohio and was a football player there and an art history major, and the two struck me at the time as incommensurate for various different reasons, and there were only a limited number of artists at that time who seemed to be producing work that dealt with that threshold. Matthew Barney became a really signal example for me, somebody who was a high school football star in Idaho, then went on to Yale to get a degree in art. So looking for those thresholds where two unlike worlds meet became really important for the formulation of the show. And it's clearly germane to everything Hudson's talking about as well.
If you have a question or comment for our guests, Christopher Bedford of the Wexner Center for the Arts and also Hudson Taylor, performance artist and wrestling coach at Columbia University, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's a certain level of courage, and I don't know where these intersect, where what Hudson did as an athlete standing up for what he believed in terms of how we depict and how we talk about people who are gay, and then doing it in the art, too. It seems to be much more accepted in the arts than it is in athletics. Yeah. How do you feel about that, Hudson?
Well, I think that the reason why that is stems from our stereotypes of masculinity and femininity. Stereotypically, men involved with theater and the arts, there's an assumption that there is a higher percentage of LGBT persons there, whereas in athletics, there's this sort of myth that in order for you to be a successful male athlete, you have to be straight. In order for you to be masculine, you have to be straight. So I think that there's been a improper defining process that's occurred for young men and young women across this country. And I think it's going to take more athletes to start to bridge that divide and show people that, no, it's not so binary. You know, we're not people exist on a continuum of interests and experiences and preferences. And I think that we just need more people to feel comfortable exploring themselves and their interests between athletics and the arts.
And I would imagine, Christopher, that it cuts both ways. Mm-hmm. So the athletics loses people mm-hmm. who could be great athletes, mm-hmm. but they're isolated by their sexuality, by their uncomfortableness in the environment that seems to be engendered there. Likewise, with the arts, you probably have lost some, it's one of those, how do you prove a negative, but mm-hmm. what you've lost in terms of talent and mm-hmm. inspiration from people who just feel like they aren't going to fit into the stereotype of the arts.
Yeah, I don't know how you would map those losses. I think that's a really astute point. I think that there are probably abundant people who had an impulse to create who may have been or currently were athletes who didn't really feel that there was a place for them in the art world. I think it's really important to try and figure out what's radical and what's provocative in different arenas. So, say, for example, to do Hard Targets, that show, in Columbus was for me much more provocative and much more radical than it would have been to do it in New York
and
or
Buckeye
Los Angeles.
Nation, right?
Yeah, where I think there's a massive self-selecting audience for art in New York and Los Angeles that expects to see a curator come up with an idea that puts pressure on a social idea like sexuality in sport. Whereas I think in Columbus, the moment you utter the word sport, it then immediately you start to think of the Buckeyes and the various different successes of the sports teams here. So to sort of perform a bait and switch in an institution like the Wexner Center, when you say this is actually about sport, but it is about sport and then various other things on top of that, it's a much more provocative platform for ideas of that sort.
Hudson, did you take a lot of flack at first, or did you take a lot of flack the entire time that you made this a point of issue as an athlete?
Well, I think I was fortunate enough. I mean, I didn't speak out and didn't try to make a difference for a very long time. There was for the majority of my life as an athlete, I was complacent and silent and did not speak out or do anything to make a difference. I think what the big turning point was for me was I was a captain of my wrestling team. I was a multiple-time All-American. So I felt like I had enough sort of cultural capital or social capital that enabled me to not really care anymore what people thought about me and what I did and what I said. I got to a place where I was really comfortable in who I was, what I believed in, and was kind of just able to gain that perspective and look back and say, you know what, as an athlete, there's a lot more that I can do than just compete on the mat. There's a lot more people that I can affect and influence than just winning titles. And you know, that's something that I think is true for any athlete at any age, because if you go to any high school in the country, the awards, the trophy stand is not academic awards. It's mostly athletic awards. So American culture places athletes up to a certain degree and gives them a certain amount of clout and influence. And I think we can affect great change in a variety of different areas. And I've just chose to do it with gay rights.
When you were, I read that some of your teammates asked you to kind of stop. They thought you were making too big of a deal out of it. But I wondered about your coaches.
My coaches have always been pretty respectful. I mean, I think the coach's role has always been to make sure that the athlete is performing their best. So I think from my coach's perspective, as long as that didn't interfere with how I was doing on the mat, then it shouldn't be something that they should, you know, try to change. With my teammates, I'd say one lesson that I learned very, very early was that there are individuals who you will not be able to talk to about politics or about religion. There are some people that have beliefs that are unmovable. And that just kind of created a lot of yelling matches that just devolved into loud noises. And little was accomplished there. So today I've tried to keep my conversation and what I'm trying to do in athletics about respect and about how we treat one another, and try to keep it as apolitical as possible, because I think that that's what's going to get the most athletes to change their words and actions.
You know, at the risk of stereotyping, you also, as I mentioned earlier, grew up in an evangelical Christian family with missionary roots. Mm. How much did that experience affect, you know, whether or not and how you communicated your issues?
I think it's still a struggle for me sometimes to talk about this with people I know because of that. You know, my namesake was this missionary to China. So I'm actually the fourth. So growing up, wherever I went, people always ask me, you know, oh, you're related to James Hudson Taylor. Like, how is your walk with God? Or, you know, just these kind of questions that I felt I always felt placed a lot of pressure and on how I could and could not act. So I think it's been very difficult for me to speak out to the religious community because I still want I want to reach them. I want to change hearts, change minds, but I know that there's a lot of obstacles to overcome when it comes to people's interpretations of the Bible, and you know, that's something that I'm not in a place to change or to question. I'm just here to try to make people love each other. but yeah, I mean, it's been a challenge. It's been a challenge, but I don't think that it's not insurmountable. I think that really anybody can agree that, you know, Tyler Clementi's suicide should have been avoidable, that Seth Walsh should not have been driven to the point where he committed suicide. And I think that that responsibility falls to all of us, religious or non-religious, athletic or not athletic, to try to make the world better and make sure that that doesn't happen to anybody else.
Christopher Bedford, Hudson's had overcome a couple different things, you know, the stereotypes and the life that he grew up with and the expectations therein, and then also his experiences being, you know, nationally ranked athlete in, mm-hmm. in a sport that already has issues. Does that make him, perhaps, do you find that those kind of double or, you know, multiple obstacles will enhance in the long run?
Oh, certainly. And I think if you find a way to foreground and objectify those concerns in a really interesting way that nobody else has been able to articulate, then I think absolutely yes. That's a really interesting, compelling route into the art world that I haven't seen that many people take. The big question for me would be the articulation of the concerns. Clearly they're there. Clearly you're Hudson right on a sort of vital threshold, and I think it's a similar one that people like Matthew Barney and Sean Leonardo occupy, and they've found ways to negotiate and found ways to make those questions, you know, variously funny, accessible, dramatic, bracing, moving. That's the big question, the leap from the concern to the materialization of the concern.
Hudson, we did lose, but I do want to say goodbye, and I want to say thanks to Hudson Taylor. He will speak this weekend at the Columbus Human Rights Campaign dinner at the Ohio Union at OSU on Saturday, June 4th. And thanks to Hudson for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The new movie Beginner stars Ewan McGregor as a graphic artist whose 75-year-old father, played by Christopher Plummer, has just come out and wants to experience the gay life he denied himself when he was married. The film was written and directed by Mike Mills, based on the story of his father. We'll talk with Mike Mills on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to join All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon for a special live broadcast from the WOSU booth at the Columbus Arts Festival. WOSU Public Media will be at the Arts Festival all weekend, June 4th, 5th, and 6th in the Discovery District. We hope to see you there for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon. More information at columbusartsfestival.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com.
Get caught up with local and national news every Friday night on WOSU-TV. Starting at 8 is Washington Week, followed by Columbus on the Record at 8:30, continuing at 9 with the McLaughlin Group. Spend your Friday night with WOSU-TV tomorrow night beginning at 8. Sunny skies today, a high of 79, currently at 73 degrees. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today we're talking about social activism and art. Let's listen to an excerpt from The Food Play. It's an original production created by local Available Light Theater Company, by the local Available Light Theater Company that begins performances this evening at the North Market.
1.7 million people in Ohio are officially poor. That's 15% of us. Of course, I say us, but if we look around the room, it's not really us, it's them.
Right now, there are 23.5 million Americans, including 6.5 million children, who live in what we call food deserts, in the inner city and in rural communities.
That was First Lady Michelle Obama talking about food deserts, and the play goes on to describe the many food deserts in Columbus. That's not your typical fare, no pun intended, for a night out at the theater. Matt Slabaugh is the artistic director of Available Light Theater. He is one of the creators of the food play being performed at the North Market beginning tonight through the 11th. Matt served on the Greater Columbus Creative Cultural Commission and teaches at Columbus College of Art and Design. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks very much.
Also, Michelle Whited.
Yes.
Is staff operations manager and company member of Available Light Theater. Michelle usually works backstage with Available Light, but has made an exception and performs in the food play. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you.
So, Matt, tell us more about the food play. What's it about?
Well,
what's the point?
We've spent about a year and a half of our lives, the company members and the people who created the play, trying to figure out what it means to eat right and trying to figure out what really is good food, with all of the kaleidoscopic implications of those words, right and good. And so we've learned a ton, and we've changed ourselves in the process. And so we're here just to share some of the information, some of the stories, some of the things we've come across, and in the process also to share some good food. We will be actually serving food provided by Local Matters and some of the vendors at the North Market. Jenny's Ice Creams is providing dessert, which I know will attract a lot of people. And I'm really, really happy that you used the word local in your introduction, because it's one of the great advantages of this being a theater production and us getting to work with such great people is that it really is a local production. It's about food issues here and now. We're talking to people from the Columbus food scene, and so it's very, very specific to our place.
And there are different people drop in on different nights.
That's right. Each night there's a segment in which we'll have an interview. Tonight we've got Bethia Wolf from Columbus Food Adventures. Jenny herself will be stopping by over the weekend. We've got Warren Taylor, who's going to blow the roof off the place next weekend, and Michael Jones from Local Matters, as well as a few other wonderful people.
And Michelle, I'm wondering, what is it about this that persuaded you to, you know, get out of your shell?
Well, you know, this has been the most involved I've been with a show since I started working with Available Light. And, you know, I really got involved last summer. I took a trip to Snowville Creamery with Matt. And, you know, from there, I was hooked. There was no getting me away from it. And so, you know, it's really personal for me. And it really means a lot to me. And it's really inspired me to grow my own food, you know, and unconventional ways, and because, you know, I don't have a very big living space or yard or anything like that, but it's just been really personal and really exciting, and so I just really wanted to be a part of it.
The food play, it's called The Food Play, by the way.
Yeah.
Is not your first original production, of course. About once a season you put on an original work focused on a social or political issue. Why is that? You know, what's the methodology of that?
Well, that's just who we are. We're really curious people, and I don't mean strange, although that's true as well. And for us, art is really a way of understanding the world and exploring the world around us. It gives one way to think of it is that it gives us an excuse to learn about something. Last year, we were doing a lot of environmental issues, and that's what led to food. And we said, well, this is the next thing we really want to tackle and understand how it works in the world. Another way some of our board members and such like to talk about it is we read a lot of books so that you don't have to. So if you want a condensed version of some of these things you're seeing in Barnes & Noble and such, you can come on down and we'll help you out with that.
What can we compare it to? I'm still trying to kind of wrap my brain around what would one see when they attend a performance of the food play?
Well, it's really a variety show is probably the best way to explain it. We've got lots of different types of performance. There's a segment that's a bit of a game show called Is It Food?, helping you figure out what is and is not food. There's a little bit of rapping. There's the film, which we heard an excerpt from earlier. We're going to have the interview as well. There's a bit that's staged as a radio play. And there's live music as well with a guy named Philip Cogley from the Saturday Giant. So it's a lot of different stuff. If you don't like what you're seeing at the moment, wait 3 minutes. It'll change. And then, of course, we've got the great food as well.
Christopher Bedford, how does this sort of performance fit into the matrix of what you do at Wexner and that sort of thing?
Well, on a literal level, we do try and sponsor these ideas as much as possible. So we have a local farmers market that actually takes place at
That's
the
right.
Wexner Center every Thursday afternoon. So on that sort of a level, we're clearly engaged. But also I would say that emphasis on the topical, the idea that art can be used as a bridge for social discussion, is a commitment we absolutely share with you all. And it's something that structures each suite of exhibitions we put up. So at the moment, we have Natalie Joburg, Pipilotti Rist, and this incredible juxtaposition of Hans Bellmer and Louise Bourgeois in our galleries. And the binding thematic there is an emphasis on gender, sexuality, and the female body. And then the next rotation, as I discussed after that, will be a green rotation, an eco-rotation. So we try to do this, not every time, but sometimes, not in an effort to be didactic or to preach or to, you know, do all the readings so that you don't have to, which is funny. Maybe we do that. Maybe I do a lot of that. But yeah, to say something through the work we do.
The farmer's market is, I'm glad you brought that up. It escaped me for a second. That's an ongoing thing.
Mm-hmm.
How does that fit in?
It doesn't really have exactly a relationship to our programming, but I just think it has a relationship to the social consciousness of the institution. And so it's something that's overseen by Shelley Castro, who's our director of education. I think she was the one that encouraged them to begin this market, and it's had a huge influence on the students, and it tends to bring people to campus that wouldn't otherwise come, that have fears about parking, et cetera, which are totally unfounded. By the way, we have lots of really easy available
parking.
If you
can get down High Street.
Yes.
Well, it's Thursday, right?
Thursday. I think it begins at 3 or 4. Somewhere around there. I wish I were more informed on that.
Okay. That's okay. Yeah. Well, we can find that out, and we can post that to our website at WOSU.org. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Matt, did you want to say something?
Well, you know, I was just going to talk about the Wexner Center. Actually, I'm a longtime Wexner Center member, and our work is really heavily influenced, especially by some of the performance groups that come through there, the City Company, Nature Theater of Oklahoma. And one of the things that we all love about the Wexner Center is they really create a great context for exploration and for, you know, learning about the world. And the farmer's market seems like just one really natural extension of that idea. Yeah, when it popped up, I didn't think twice at all. I said, oh, of course they are.
Mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm,
exactly what they should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are some, if you look back, and this is for any of you, when you look back at the kind of art you enjoy, if it's theatrical or whatever it is, what has the staying power that also was making a point? I think, you know, last year or last summer, you did the To Kill a Mockingbird.
We did, yes.
Which still seems, even though it's cloaked in all this, the language of the day, still seems very relevant.
Absolutely. That's a power, a play and a book that have the power to change you. And that's one thing that we're really, really after, is giving people the opportunity to really engage a subject very deeply and to walk out with a few things on their mind that, you know, that will stick with them for weeks afterwards and maybe make a small change in their life. And if we have a few hundred people making these small changes, eventually that's how we make larger changes.
So is there something that goes way back into your experience, something, the first play you ever saw that made you feel that way? And Christopher, you too, is in terms just as a curator or just as an art lover, that you first felt that change, that this has changed me. It's not just pretty, but it's changed me in how I feel about something or made me think about something.
Yeah, I mean, for me, absolutely, there was one sort of signal experience, which was seeing a suite of paintings by a German painter called Gerhard Richter, and I saw them in New York at the time. And they dealt with a radical left-wing organization in Germany during the 70s called the RAF. And what I was struck by was the fact that these young people had been understood during the period as terrorists. And Richter had painted them 10, 11 years later and had imbued the paintings with such incredible humanity. And it seemed to me to advance the possibilities of history painting in a way that I'd never conceived possible. So I was not only formally interested, they were beautiful, but they foregrounded social questions that I thought were unbroachable. And that was, I would say that was that important moment when I understood what I wanted to do and how I could possibly make that experience available for other people. That was a sort of heady one, but I do think that there are ways to activate the same experience on the variety of levels, whether it relates to food or the body or just general social political consciousness.
What about you, Michelle?
I've only been working with Available Light since 2008 was when I first started, and we did a show called Dirty Math a few years ago, and it just amazed me how uneducated I was on economics and the whole everything surrounding it and how deeply it affected my life. And I mean, I was working on that show and I didn't even realize until after it had been open for a week or so that, you know, it was how much it was impacting me. And
because you were still thinking about it.
Yeah. And I was still like right in the moment and, you know, I was not listening as much as I was working. And, you know, now I look back and I mean, that's the play that really kind of, you know, inspired me to think more socially about art and how it really can affect us. And it's not just, you know, what we're trying to tell our audiences, but I mean, it really does change us when we're creating it. And I've learned so much through some of these shows that we've created and just, you know, just if I feel like a better person because I'm learning so much about these things. So
what about you, Matt?
Oh, I've got two in my mind. About 15 years ago was the first time I encountered the work of Anne Bogart in the City Company, and she talks a lot about how artists and theater in particular have a real responsibility to examine the culture in which the art is created. And seeing her work, especially, there was one called Cabin Pressure, actually, is about the theater, so it really struck home. That changed my work completely. But even earlier than that, I think I was in 10th grade when the musical Falsettos came on tour to Columbus. I was really, really naive. I was really, I was a 10th grader.
You're 10th grader, right?
Yeah. So Falsettos comes through and presents a really, really personal vision of sort of recent history of gay America, which was something I knew almost nothing about at the time. And my head really just exploded. And I cried like a baby at the show and went home and had a whole new way of seeing the world. And I'll never forget that experience.
You said there were two.
The second being Anne Bogart and encountering the City Company's work. Okay. Yeah, so one was more as a patron and someone viewing the work, but the other was as a theater person relating to the other way that people were creating work.
I thought it was an interesting comment that Michelle made, and I was wondering, Christopher, if that's the same way in different areas of the art world as far as people being changed by their own work.
Yeah, I think that's really – people always ask this question. Not necessarily within the art world, within that self-selecting group of experts, but if you're giving gallery talk at the major museum, there's always some agitator in the crowd who says something like, well, what does art do? And what does it mean to you? And then, of course, you have to come up with a rote answer for that very
something
taxing
really cool
question. And they say, well, what does it do to the world? And I say, well, of course, art doesn't change the world, but it does change people, and people change the world. So there's your answer. And I think it changes me and it changes the people who make the work. So without question.
When, you know, I've been to conversations with artists at the mm-hmm. Wexner, and sometimes that kind of pops up. People ask, how mm-hmm. did you feel about this when you finished it?
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of a thing. And how do they respond to that? To create something like that mm-hmm. out of nothing to most of us is...
I think the pressure...
Amazing in itself.
No, I think that is amazing. I think the pressure that's involved with creating something in anticipation of its reception is something that artists don't think about because it would mean too much for the studio practice to think about, what is everybody else going to think? Mm-hmm. I think that they meet the basic condition of the work being meaningful and effective to them, and then they understand it as having a kind of free-floating effect in the world that they can't control, but that they hope resonates for different people in different ways. That to me, is the sort of operation. Otherwise, trying to account for everybody's response while still making it, I think, would be the most – it would be difficult.
You know, Matt and Michelle, one of the things about Available Light is I mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird from last summer, but that's a very mm-hmm. rare thing that you take something that's established like that. Usually it's original.
Yes.
What you're doing.
Yes. About half of our works are completely original, created by the company, and about 45% of the others are very, very new plays by playwrights from around the country.
So what is the difference in terms of that the art of theater when you're you're putting on a production of something that's very familiar to people versus something that they've never seen before?
Right. Well, the process is really different. When you're dealing with an established work, you're really trying to figure out what it already means to people and also how it's personal to you and how you can stage it. With the original works, it's much more of a frenzy – We're very harried. We open tonight.
Yes.
You want to know a secret?
Thank you for coming in, by the way. I
sure.
hadn't thought of that.
Yes,
it's no. crazy.
Let me give you a secret for our listeners. Last night we ran through the show and we had just a few special guests in to watch it. And we said, thanks for coming. Now get out because we have to work. And we immediately sat down on the table and said, all right, how are we going to cut 30 minutes out of this play?
Wow.
And the rest of us kind of panicked.
So that's what we've been doing last night. We realized that we tried to say too much, which happens sometimes.
And it's great content. We just needed to do a little trimming.
Yeah. So the original work is a lot about figuring out what works and what doesn't. To Kill a Mockingbird, well, thank goodness, somebody's already edited that thing. And we didn't have to worry about it so much.
Yeah.
But sometimes your best ideas turn out to be not the ones that are most suitable for the piece.
That's very common if you're ever looking for a commonality between that and newspaper journalism. Mm. How are you going to cut 30 inches out of something practically overnight? That's a very common. We call it killing babies.
Yeah, me too.
We talked about that last night too.
That was morbid. We actually have someone pregnant in the company. She didn't want to hear about it.
Did you refer to it that? Did you say?
Oh, yeah. You have to kill your children.
Yeah. Kill your children. Well, I want to let everybody know who we're talking to once again and let you know that we'll have links to the Wexner Center for the Arts. Joining us today was Christopher Bedford. He's chief curator of exhibitions there. He was an assistant curator in contemporary art at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and he serves on the Arts and Memorials Public Art Committee at Ohio State University. Christopher, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Appreciate it. And then earlier we had Hudson Taylor. He is going to be appearing next, this weekend at the Human Rights Campaign's dinner at the Ohio Union. We'll have a link to that as well at our website at WOSU.org. And then the food play. Joining us today is Matt Slabaugh. He's artistic director at Available Light Theater, and also Michelle Whited. She is a staff operations manager at Available Light Theater and also performer in this case. And Matt, can you tell us a little bit more about where it's going to be and what the deal is and where people should go?
Sure. The play is at the North Market. It is upstairs. There's a big room called the Dispatch Kitchen. You can park in the North Market's parking lot. The show is going to start at 8 o'clock most nights, except 2 o'clock on Sunday. We do recommend you get there as much as a half hour early. It will be family dinner style with sitting around tables, so you want to get there early to make sure you can...
And save an appetite?
Well, save a bit of an appetite. Yeah, we're going to have taste. It's not going to be a dinner. You're not going to get a steak. But, do leave a little bit of room, especially for that Jenny's at the end if you stick around for the talk back. Tickets available online. You can go to thefoodplay.com.
All right. We'll have all those on our website at WOSU.org. And Matt, once again, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Michelle, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
And Christopher, thanks for staying for the whole hour. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Speaking of the arts, All Sides with Ann Fisher will have a special production tomorrow. We'll be live at the Columbus Arts Festival. If you want to find out where we're going to be and what time, well, I can tell you right now, it'll be 10 to noon as usual. And we'll have the phones open as well. So if you want to give us a call, please do. If you can visit us, even better, go to WOSU.org/allsides and we'll have the location down there for you. Hopefully, I won't get lost on my way to the booth. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.